Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, July 30th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible this week by signing up to be patrons of the show. If you're interested in supporting the show so that we can continue to produce Talk Nerdy week after week and make it 100% free to download, you've just got to visit patreon.com/talknerdy. Again, that's Patreon, patreon.com/talknerdy. You can read all about the awards and the milestones and all the great ways to join the Patreon community. The top supporters this week include Rob Schreck, Timothy Glover, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. There are also a lot more patrons who support the show. I give a shout out at the top of the show for everybody who supports at the $25 or more per episode level. So I just want to thank you guys again so much for all of your incredible support. I had the honor of doing a really important interview, I think, this week, and one that I learned an awful lot from. So her name is Dr. Helen Pates Jammet. She's a medical entomologist, and she is the global head of research and market access for Vestergaard. Now, she focuses specifically on malaria prevention, research, and vector control product development. So she works for a company that makes mosquito nets, and she has done a lot of work looking into R&D of mosquito nets and seeing how effective they can be in preventing malaria. She's done a lot of work with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where she was supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She was also a consultant medical entomologist for the American Biophysics Corporation in Tanzania, where she worked at a research station evaluating mosquito traps. So she's done a lot of really important work. Her PhD is in infectious diseases, and she has a Master of Science in Medical Parasitology from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So much important content. So without further ado, let's dive right in. Here she is, Dr. Helen Pates Jammet. Well, Helen, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for the invite.
So where are we connecting from right now? Because I sense a bit of an accent.
Well, I'm actually based in Washington, D.C., but I'm British, although I haven't lived in the U.K. for around 25 years now.
Really? You've maintained your accent well. I know a lot of people who have lived in the U.S. for that long who have really kind of converted over to the American way of speaking.
Well, I've only actually been in the U.S. for 4 years. Before that, I lived in Tanzania, in East Africa, in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, a little bit in France. So I tend to pick up little bits of the accent depending on where I'm living in. So maybe in a couple of years time, I'll be a little bit more Americanized.
So you've really been all over, and that's because of the incredible work that you do. Today, we're really going to focus on mosquitoes. We're going to focus on mosquitoes as a vector. We're going to talk a lot about the diseases that mosquitoes bring and what we can do to protect ourselves from them, but also a little bit about that entomology. So you study bugs, but you specifically have focused on mosquitoes for most of your career?
Yes, that's right. I'm a medical entomologist, which means I study insects of medical importance. So that includes insects like mosquitoes, ticks, sandflies, tsetse flies. And I've concentrated most of my career on mosquitoes, specifically looking at mosquito behavior and ways to prevent mosquitoes from biting and spreading disease.
So this is a big problem all the world over. And I think that most of us, when we hear mosquito, we think annoying first, but we also do think disease. And most people, even here in the U.S., are well aware of malaria as a very dangerous disease that affects a lot of people globally. But people in the U.S. aren't at risk, really, of contracting malaria unless they travel. So I would love to maybe dive deep into malaria first, simply because I'm not sure if my general audience, I bet you there's a fair amount of people who listen to the show who have had personal experience, you know, having to take prophylaxis or having to be really wary when they travel in certain areas. But there are probably a lot of people who listen to the show who are like, oh, malaria doesn't affect me. I don't really know much about it.
Sure, yeah. So, and malaria, often people think that they can get a vaccine for malaria like you do for plenty of other diseases when you travel. But unfortunately, that's not the case yet. There is an experimental vaccine that's just being tested, but it's not as effective as was hoped. And we still have some way to go before we get something that would give you the same kind of protection that you would get, for example, from a yellow fever vaccine. But malaria has actually been around for quite a long time. It's thought to have evolved from an infection via the oral fecal route to infecting the liver and then infecting blood cells before adapting to develop and survive in mosquitoes. It's thought that it probably evolved first in birds and then reptiles before then moving to primates and rodents. There's a total of 5 different types of malaria parasite that infect humans. It's a single-celled organism that has a part of its life cycle in the mosquito and then the rest of it in humans. And today there's around 260 million cases worldwide. And last year there was an estimated around 445,000 deaths. The African region has around 90% of the cases and 91% of the deaths.
And the rest of them, are they in South America? Where is it also more common?
Southeast Asia and parts of South America. So there are countries in South America that have been doing a very good job of working towards elimination and eradication. Unfortunately, Venezuela, because of a lot of the political difficulties there right now, has seen a resurgence in recent times. So it's of course a disease that does cross borders because both people travel and mosquitoes travel. So when you're looking at strategies to control it, you really have to be thinking on a kind of holistic scale, not just focusing on one country, but looking at the borders and nearby countries as well.
So when we talk about malaria as a disease, what we are talking about is an infection. And you mentioned that this is a single-celled organism. It's a parasite. So this is not a bacterial infection. It's not a viral infection. What type of organism is it? Is it like a protist?
It's a protozoa that belongs to that's called a plasmodium.
Okay.
So it's a it infects. It, in fact, it's transmitted in the saliva of the mosquito. So when the mosquito goes to bite you, people often think of mosquitoes as flying syringes. They're in fact not flying syringes. It's a lot more complicated than that. They have their mouth parts are called a proboscis, and they actually consist of 6 parts. So there's 2 needles that have tiny teeth that saw through the skin, and then another 2 needles that hold the skin tissue apart, and then another needle that detects the blood vessels and then acts like a straw to suck up the blood. And then the remaining needle injects saliva into the skin to help the blood flow more easily. The saliva prevents blood vessels from constricting, stops the blood from clotting, and prevents inflammation when the mosquito is sucking up the blood. Of course, people will be familiar with the itchy reaction that happens when you get bitten. Usually you get an allergic reaction that's a red itchy bump. And scratching it usually makes it worse because you're spreading the saliva, which increases the allergic response and then obviously makes you itch more. And you become less sensitive the more you're bitten. So that's why adults often have less serious mosquito bites than children do.
Oh my gosh, that's fascinating. I had no idea their mouth parts were so complicated.
Yeah, you can't see it because you just see one little spike when they come and try and bite you. So, but the parasite is in the saliva. And so when they find that blood vessel and they inject the saliva, the parasite enters the bloodstream, moves to the liver, and then starts to develop in the liver. And once it's got to a certain stage there, it breaks out of the liver into the bloodstream, and you have male parasites and female parasites in the bloodstream. And when that whole process usually takes around 7 to 10 days. And when another mosquito comes to bite you, it will pick up those male and female parasites in the bloodstream. Those enter the stomach of the mosquito where there's basically sexual reproduction. The male and the female parasites break out of the blood cells and fuse, And then you have a development inside the stomach of the mosquito. It moves to the wall of the stomach of the mosquito, develops through the wall of the stomach, and then on the outside of the stomach, and eventually migrates up to the salivary gland so that the mosquito is then infective. And because it takes 7 to 10 days for the infection to develop, it means that basically you need to have a mosquito that is usually around 10 days old in order for it to carry malaria. So the older the mosquito is, the more likely it is to be infected.
Interesting, because then it's got that whole life cycle that's already sort of taken place and it's ready to then infect another person or its first person.
Exactly, yeah. And it's not malaria as I mentioned, it infects other species as well. You have, when I was doing my master's degree at the London School, there was some outreach from the London Zoo because they had a problem in their penguins that were kept being infected with malaria. So it's not just people that have problems with malaria.
You mentioned birds as an early source, and of course, penguins are birds too. Is it a problem with other large mammals?
But usually you have species-specific malaria. So the malaria has developed to for example, a mouse malaria won't infect a human. But you do have some primate malarias. There's one that's recently emerged over the last few years in the Malaysian Borneo Peninsula region called Plasmodium knowlesi. And this is a malaria parasite that was infecting monkeys and then jumped from monkeys to humans. And it's quite a nasty one because it looks like one of the more benign forms of malaria, but in fact, it kills like one of the more lethal forms of malaria. So it's really important that you figure out exactly what type of malaria is infecting the patient in order to be able to treat it properly.
And so, you know, I think that, gosh, there's so much I want to talk about. I'm trying to even organize my thoughts about how to approach it. But I think that when we think of malaria, oftentimes in the West, again, we think of it as a disease of the other. We think of it as a disease that doesn't affect us here. And it's only in, you know, tropical areas, developing countries, you know, whatever kind of bias or stereotype or prejudice we tend to use against, unfortunately, the population that's probably most vulnerable to it. And we often think of malaria as like a really, really bad flu that can kill people. Is that a terrible analogy? Or is it a completely, I mean, obviously it's not viral. So right there's a big difference. But is it have similar types of symptoms, but are just kind of a little worse than the flu? Or is that just a bad way to think about it?
Well, a few things here. I think people very often think of the flu, very often use the flu to talk about bad colds. And when you actually have the flu, it can be really, really bad and really lethal. But with malaria, it depends on the type of malaria you have. So in sub-Saharan Africa, the most common form of malaria is what's known as cerebral malaria, caused by a parasite known as Plasmodium falciparum. And this is a parasite that has an affinity for the small capillaries of the brain. And it can collect there very quickly and clog the brain and kill you very, very quickly. So in general, if you survive, if you live in a malaria endemic region and survive beyond the age of 5, you have enough immunity that has built up to give you some level of protection for the rest of your life, unless you leave that region, in which case you tend to lose that protection. But I've known people who have lived there, people who Europeans who've lived in Africa for many years and then got sick and literally 24 hours later were dead. I have a couple of people that I know that have, and other people who have been very, very close to it and luckily were able to get enough treatment fast enough. And that's really the problem, is being able to have the diagnosis and get treated with effective drugs fast enough, because it really does need to be treated quickly, particularly those more lethal forms. I've had malaria once in my life. It happened at the same time. My husband and I, we were living in Tanzania at the time, and we both came down with it around the same time. He he came down with the symptoms a few hours before I did. We figured out that we were so obsessive about mosquito protection when we were living there. We didn't take any prophylaxis because we were obviously living there long term, but we used to spray our house with insecticide. We used to sleep under insecticide treated nets that were regularly retreated. When we went outside at night, we'd wear skin repellent, light colors, long sleeves or pants if it wasn't too hot and uncomfortable. And the only time that we were exposed during that period was when we went to a friend's, a neighbor's house. She had a fancy dress party and we stayed out until 2 o'clock in the morning without repellent. Basically, it takes one bite. And from my experience, it was probably the only, and it's the only mosquito-borne disease I've had. I haven't had anything else like dengue or chikungunya, but it felt, you could feel every joint in your body. I had a terrible, terrible headache. I had a fever. My husband had a very high fever and was sweating so much. We had to put towels on the bed and in within about 10 minutes, they were completely soaking. We had to keep replacing them. And you're vomiting, you have diarrhea, wow. And you basically feel like you're dying. It's really, really awful disease. And some people have a lot of long-term consequences as well. You can have problems with various different organs in your body that can be affected. You can have long-term mental health issues. And very often those kinds of side effects aren't really talked about, but it's pretty bad and definitely not anything I would wish anybody to have. I really take my hat off to volunteers in those studies that try to help with developing drugs and vaccines by getting infected experimentally.
Wow. And so do you know what kind of malaria you two had?
Yeah, we had the falciparum malaria. So that's the cerebral form. And basically once it's treated... Yeah, but basically, once it's treated, it's out of your system. So once you've taken the drugs, it's then gone from your system. Another form of malaria, which also circulates throughout Africa and is very present in Southeast Asia, is a form called vivax malaria. And this type of malaria has certain stages that hide in the liver cells and then get released at certain periods of time. Which can cause relapses. So you can feel absolutely fine, and then suddenly you come down with the infection again.
Oh my gosh! So it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Exactly. Yeah, and that type of malaria requires a different drug because you need a drug that will attack the parasite in the liver and kill those hidden stages in the liver, which requires something that currently the drugs we have are more toxic and need patients to. Take them for an extended period of time. And if you stop taking it, then it might not be fully effective.
I see. So it's like get the infection in check first so that you feel better and then also treat this kind of long-term, I don't know, this creeping infection that's still in your liver.
Yeah. And one of the big problems is that there are many, many people out there that are asymptomatic. So this is obviously in malaria endemic regions of the world. So you have people that are walking around with parasites, but they absolutely feel fine. They don't get treated unless they have a fever. And that is one of the difficulties when we look towards malaria eradication. Trying to do that is a huge task because you have such an enormous pool of disease that you can't necessarily track down. So trying to find out exactly, because unless you can get rid of all of those parasites from that population, it's always going to keep coming back.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked before on this show about poliovirus, which is, of course, an incredibly different type of disease. And we talked quite a bit. I had a researcher that actually the lead polio researcher from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on the show. And we talked about the idea of eradication and why we can actually have a real conversation about polio eradication when we can't have a conversation about, I don't know, eradicating influenza or eradicating other viruses, for example, that are zoonotic in nature, because polio can only kind of live in people. And we know that once we get rid of polio in people, there is no more polio. But when we use the word eradication with malaria, are we talking about the same thing? Like, is there really a future where there could be no more of those protists?
It's an ambition that is better than trying to continually control it.
Okay.
The benefits of actually eradicating it are huge from a productivity perspective, from an economic perspective. Malaria has been estimated to cost Africa more than $12 billion every year in gross domestic product. And malaria-free countries have five times greater economic growth than those with malaria. It's been estimated that eradicating malaria could save around 11 million lives and $2 trillion in economic losses. And that's why there's a lot of investments from both the U.S. companies and the U.S. government to help both control and prevent malaria. We have successfully eradicated malaria from certain parts of the world in the past. The WHO began a worldwide malaria eradication program in 1955. And the last indigenous malaria cases in England and the US were in the 1950s, and in Holland, in the Netherlands in 1961. And the WHO declared Europe malaria free in 1975, but then a year later declared the eradication program a failure.
Why?
So there were the failures. Well, first of all, there were very good reasons why there were factors that led to the decline of malaria in Europe and the US. A lot of them attributed to progress.
Mm-hmm.
Things like improved drainage and land reclamation, changes in crops, so that people were producing more fodder to keep animals throughout the year. Rural populations declining as machinery was introduced, improved housing, greater access to medical care, and then, of course, the use of DDT that was introduced after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the factors that led to the failure of the program were, ironically, resistance to the insecticide DDT, drug resistance, increased population and movement, forest clearance, irrigation, other agricultural activities, urbanization, deterioration of public services, deterioration of vector control operations, and then, of course, disruptions from war, civil strife, and natural disasters. Now, if you think about it, there's quite a lot of those factors are still occurring today. We have a big problem of insecticide resistance today. We have drug resistance to the more recent and very effective malaria drugs in an area of Southeast Asia, and there's a big effort to try and contain that. You have, of course, continuous migration. You have a lot of agricultural activities. There's still, in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, very poor health services. And you, of course, have a lot of civil strife and natural disasters in many places. And I think, you know, we have to consider that climate change is a potential concern also. There may be areas of the world where you have the malaria mosquito, but there's no malaria yet, but there is a potential for those mosquitoes to become infected again if the conditions were right. And you can see already certain mosquito-borne diseases entering areas where they weren't before. So you have, for example, in southern Europe, in France and Greece and Italy, you have a virus called chikungunya, which has been mm-hmm. circulating there for the last few years. You have a brand new virus that I read about recently that has been found in France called Usutu virus. Very often these diseases are named after the places that they were originally detected. Mm-hmm. So I think eradication is a noble goal. It requires a huge amount of effort and resources and planning. It's complicated by the fact that you have asymptomatic carriers, that you have mosquitoes that fly across borders. It's something that is not going to take a short amount of time. If we ever achieve it, it will take many decades.
You know, speaking of kind of the effects of climate change and the fact that they may be it may be really making this a battle a more difficult one. I have a friend, when we were in college together, she was very interested in microbiology and went on to graduate school. We still stay in touch, but we didn't go to graduate school together. We went to undergrad, and she studied microbiology and entomology, and she was very interested in mosquito-borne illness here in the U.S. And so she was specifically focused on West Nile at the time. And we've definitely noticed just within the last, like, you know, two decades that the not just the disease, like you had mentioned, you know, the mosquitoes that might carry malaria might be in certain parts of the world, but the malaria itself hasn't gotten there yet, that the infectious aspect of malaria. But aren't we also seeing, so we're seeing West Nile that's getting like more and more northerly in America. Like, we used to only think of West Nile as a disease that affected like southern Texas. And then it started to kind of grow and kind of Florida. But then it started to go up and up and up. And now we're seeing not just that like West Nile is in more places or Zika's coming up into the U.S., but also that, I don't know if this is anecdotal, but I live in California now. I grew up in Texas, but now I live in Los Angeles. There are more there were no mosquitoes here when I got here. Like, that was my great joy of living in California. It's like, there's no bugs. And of course, now I'm getting bit by mosquitoes in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and a very, very often this is the tiger mosquito, this little black and white mosquito that bites during the day. It's called Aedes albopictus, and it's an invasive species that has spread throughout the world. It originated in Southeast Asia and was spread primarily through the trade of used tires. It lays its eggs in temporary water, and then the eggs are very drought resistant, drought tolerant, so they can basically sit there while there's no water, and then as soon as there's water that touches them, they'll hatch out, and then you get clouds of mosquitoes coming out. So it's one of the mosquitoes that's spread right through the US. It's also spreading in Europe, and even Aedes aegypti, actually, which is one of the mosquitoes that is another huge problem globally, because it's responsible for dengue, for chikungunya, for Zika. And it's there's approximately half of the world's population that's at risk of infection with dengue, for example. So just to give you a picture of how much of the world is actually exposed to, or at least at risk of infective bites from this mosquito. And
that's as of right now, right? That's as of like no big changes, but that could just continue to get worse.
Yeah. And some of these viruses that mosquitoes carry are actually, so you have the mosquitoes that can bite you, and then the virus is transferred to your body and it infects you, and then another mosquito bites you, picks up the virus, and that's how the infection spreads. But you also have some mosquitoes that are actually able to keep the virus circulating by passing it from the adults to the egg stages, which is also another way for the virus to survive when mosquitoes are hibernating over winter. So that the virus stays in the next generation of mosquitoes that emerge. So for example, West Nile virus can be transmitted like that. So can dengue, chikungunya. So it's another form that can make it very difficult to completely get rid of those diseases.
Wow. And so, okay, we mentioned, you mentioned that there is no malaria vaccine, that there are people working on it, but of course this is not something that's available to anybody. But we have used the term prophylaxis a few times. So there are specific drugs that individuals can take if they're visiting an area with malaria. But the drugs, I mean, not to deter anybody, because absolutely, if your physician, your travel doctor, whoever you're working with, recommends that you take the prophylaxis, like, that's, you know, you follow the orders of your doctor and have that real conversation. But the drugs do carry their own risks and their own side effects with them, don't they?
Yes, they do. And it depends. That's why very often doctors advise their patients to take them for usually a week before they travel, so that they can get used to the drug and make sure that there's no massive side effects that can prevent them. So some of those drugs can make your stomach feel very upset. And if you're, for example, on holiday or traveling or even on business and you're vomiting all the time, then clearly that's not very comfortable. One of the prophylactic drugs is doxycycline is one of the fairly good prophylactic drugs, but it makes your skin more sensitive to sunlight, which obviously isn't very good if you have have very sensitive skin and also traveling in an area where you have a lot of sunshine.
Which is probably the case if it's mosquito
exactly,
prone.
Yeah. Because, most tropical areas, yeah. And it also tends to make you more susceptible to fungal infections, which is also not very comfortable. Mm. So, and then there's another drug that has led some people to have, it's led to depression and even mental episodes. Some people, that's a drug called Larium, and some people support it very well, and other people simply do not feel comfortable mentally on that drug. So
yeah,
there's another one called Malarone, which tends to be better supported by most people. But it's a reason why...
It's good to know.
Yeah, you know, it's a reason why it's important to understand how to protect yourself from mosquitoes as well as taking the prophylaxis, because obviously if you can prevent yourself from being bitten in the first place, then that helps to prevent the disease from appearing in your system.
Well, and I want to talk about all of those different ways that people can, you know, be empowered and make decisions to prevent the infection to begin with. But obviously one of the most important reasons too is you may take a malaria prophylaxis, but malaria is not the only insect-borne disease. Like, just because you're preventing malaria, which is very, very important, many places that have malaria, as you mentioned, you might also have concerns about mosquito-borne diseases like dengue or chikungunya. There might be sand flies, and you might be concerned about leishmaniasis or other kinds of diseases that are endemic in those areas. Like, if you can prevent yourself from getting bitten in the first place, that's the best thing that you can do, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the reason why insecticide treated mosquito nets have been so successful in controlling malaria, and of course can be used against other diseases. But it's when you're thinking about how to protect yourself from different diseases and the mosquitoes that carry, or insects that carry, those different diseases, it's really important to understand where you're traveling and what kind of diseases are there, because you have many different types of, if we're just looking at mosquitoes, there's over 3,500 different species of mosquito, and different types of mosquitoes have different behaviors. So some like to bite humans only, and others prefer animals or birds. Some will bite whatever is there. They're called opportunistic. Some mosquitoes like to bite during the day, whereas some tend to bite only at night while you're sleeping. Some bite out indoors, others bite outdoors. And we have to be able to understand that behavior and the diseases they transmit if we want to effectively control and prevent those diseases. So one of the reasons why the mosquito net has been so effective in sub-Saharan Africa is because mosquitoes, in general, mosquitoes tend to bite during the night, and their peak biting time is in the early hours of the morning. And that tends to be when people are sleeping and in their beds. And therefore, if you prevent that mosquito from biting you, then you can prevent that disease from infecting you, the parasite from infecting you.
Absolutely. And of course, it, like you said, it is so important to know those different behaviors and the risk factors. And I think that for people who live in these areas and always have lived, obviously there's a lot of folk wisdom that comes up that sometimes is legitimate and helpful, and sometimes is actually something, you know, pseudoscience that you have to kind of fight against. But people generally start to develop an understanding of their surroundings because it's what they know. And so, you know, when I was growing up in Texas in the South, where we have a horrible problem with mosquitoes, although we're not as concerned about the illness that comes from it and more just the horrific immune reaction. I remember when West Nile first became a conversation as I was growing up in Texas. But when I was a kid, just getting bit by mosquitoes meant you were going to be miserable. That's all that anybody's really concerned about. But you knew that mosquitoes in Texas, or at least the ones that were really pernicious, were crepuscular. You do not stay outside during dusk and dawn. Yeah. you're going to get eaten alive. And so people just know that. They know if they're out on a patio having dinner and the sun starts to set, they'd better move the party indoors because they're going to start getting eaten. And that is, I think, important for individuals of different cultures. But of course, there becomes a big problem when people start to travel.
Yeah, there are plenty of products out there that don't work. And it tends to give the products that do work a lot harder job to convince people that these are the types of things that you should be doing to protect yourself from mosquitoes.
Geez, so let's talk about those. I want to know about, you know, all these different types of products on the market. You, of course, work with a company that specializes in mosquito nets, and I want to talk about those in particular as well. I've got to ask you, so I just visited the Peruvian Amazon, and I stayed in a really beautiful, lovely ecotourism lodge that focuses on citizen science with mostly macaws. They have a big macaw research project called Rainforest Expeditions. And this was my first time sleeping under a mosquito net in my life. And so, you know, I talked to a lot of people who work there. I talked to a lot of people who visited on a regular basis. I wore long sleeves, long pants. I tucked my pants into my socks before putting on my mud boots. When you'd go out into the forest, you'd wear mud boots. Many of my clothes were treated with permethrin, and I wore DEET on all of my exposed skin. And then I slept under these mosquito nets that actually tucked underneath the mattresses of the beds. They were the square types that tucked in. Yeah. Did I miss anything?
No, it sounds like you were the perfect student.
Oh, good. And so these are but this is hard to do every day. And what I noticed is that many of the people who actually contracted there, one of the biggest problems was leishmaniasis. So yes, they were concerned about mosquitoes. There are mosquito-borne illnesses like dengue and chikungunya. There, sand flies are a big, big issue. And so leishmaniasis is a big problem. And we noticed that many of the guides more often contracted it than the tourists and the visitors, because when you live in a place like that and you're doing that every day, you start to get a little lazy. You slip on your flip-flops without putting DDT on. You go, oh, it's just too hot today, I'm going to wear a tank top. And we noticed that a lot of people would get it on their calves, their shins and their calves, because that's where the sandflies would tend to bite them. They would just wear shorts. They would be like, I can't deal with it, it's too hot today. Like, you just start to slip. And it's one thing if you're visiting and you are a good student like myself and you're like, I've got a week, I'm going to be really on it. But when you live in a place and you have to live your life, you can get a little bit complacent, can't you?
Absolutely. And the whilst skin repellents are very effective, they can be sticky and uncomfortable, and particularly in a hot climate. And of course, you have to keep reapplying them. And when you're using products with DEET in, it has this plasticizing effect. So anything you touch afterwards, like a car seat or a pair of sunglasses or even some shoes, they can start to melt or go a little bit soft. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily always the nicest solution. So certainly, at least for mosquitoes, one of the things that's very often advised is for people to wear lighter colors, because mosquitoes tend to be attracted to dark colors, and to wear longer, cover your skin so you wear longer sleeves, longer pants. Of course, that's not always comfortable in hot weather, and mosquitoes can bite through a pair of jeans. So it's not necessarily going to help either.
Ready to become a leader? Enroll in Army ROTC. You could get a full tuition scholarship, and you'll graduate a leader and an officer in the U.S. Army. Army officers inspire strength in others. To receive more information about the Army ROTC program, visit goarmy.com/podcast today. Paid for by the United States Army. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. And what about the treated clothing? Because they tend not to smell. They tend, like the permethrin, the actual fibers being treated with insect repellent.
So it depends where you're traveling. Okay. Permethrin is a chemical that belongs to a class of insecticides called pyrethroids, They have been around for many years and have been fairly effective. They've got a good safety profile, which means you're able to put them in close contact with the skin, which is why you're able to put them on clothing. But there are many mosquitoes in many parts of the world now that are resistant to permethrin, meaning that doesn't really affect them. They can land on it now. It doesn't chase them away like it used to. And there's been a big effort, particularly by the DOD in the US, to try to find replacements. And one of the difficulties is trying to find something that is safe enough to use in such close proximity with the human skin, and that is as effective, has such quick action as a pyrethroid like permethrin.
Interesting. Because, yeah, a lot of people see that, I think, as a bit of a shortcut. You know, the clothes are pre-treated, or you can treat them yourself. It takes a while, but...
Yeah, so, and some of it depends on what technology is being used. And I haven't tested any of these myself, but permethrin is more photostable than the... So the pyrethroids come from chrysanthemums originally. They're a synthetic version of pyrethrum, which is a natural insecticide that comes from chrysanthemums. And that the pyrethrum was is very photosensitive. So the synthetic versions were developed to be more photostable, but they still break down, decompose fairly quickly in sunlight. And
awesome.
Yeah. So basically the long-term efficacy of products like treated clothing is determined by how wash resistant the formulation is. So does the insecticide withstand multiple washes in a washing machine? And how stable is it when you're wearing your t-shirt or pair of pants or whatever it is outside in the bright sunshine for long periods of time? And in addition to that, the combined effect of sunlight and washing tends to be much worse than just one or the other.
Yeah. And of course, depending on where you are, that can be a big issue. When you're in the rainforest, luckily, I was only really in bright sunlight when I was traveling on the river itself in boats. But when you're in the rainforest, you've got that nice canopy cover. So you're actually not in bright sunlight very often. But of course, if you're in or a forest in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, but if you're on an open plain or you're in an area where, yeah, you're going to be outside working, enjoying the sunlight, that can be a really big problem. But it's one, you know, tool in the toolkit. And of course, there are other tools, aren't there?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And there's some simple things. Of course, it's always more challenging if you're traveling. But some of the other things that you can do include, if it's mosquitoes that bite indoors, just simply using a fan or air conditioning can help. Removing standing water from areas where you're living, emptying or covering storage containers on a regular basis, that can help to get rid of the sites where mosquitoes breed.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah,
because
sure.
I think that's one of those things that's like, I think people kind of know it. It's become folk wisdom. Oh, mosquitoes like standing water, or mosquitoes breed in standing water, or mosquitoes breed in swamps. But I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, the difference between male and female mosquitoes, you know, who bites, who doesn't, why is the water a risk factor for mosquitoes gathering? So maybe we can, I mean, you have so much expertise. Every question I ask you, you're like, pew, 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 I know the answer, which makes me so happy. You're like, I've got stats. I've got data. So why is it that standing water is attractive? Is it where they drink? Do they lay their eggs in it? Like, what's going on with this?
So first of all, it's only the female mosquito that feeds on blood. The male mosquitoes feed on sugar sources, nectar and other sugar sources that they find in nature. The females feed on blood because they need the protein in the blood to mature their eggs. And that's with the exception of one species of mosquito called Toxorhynchites, also known as the elephant mosquito.
Okay.
This is a large mosquito that can grow to about 1.5 inches in length. The larvae of this mosquito actually eat other mosquito larvae. And luckily, that type of mosquito doesn't feed on blood. They only feed on sugary substances from plants and flowers, because you can imagine an inch and a half size mosquito feeding on you would be pretty scary.
Oh, gosh.
But anyway, mosquitoes have different parts of their life cycle. You have the adults, which are the flying insects with wings, and the females lay their eggs in water, on water, or near water, or near some kind of humid substance. Those eggs then hatch out, and you have four larval stages. So you have a tiny, tiny larva that comes out of the egg, and then they molt, and they have a slightly larger larva. So you go through four larval molts, and then you have a pupa, which is a stage that doesn't feed, but it's very active, moves around very quickly. And then the adult mm-hmm. emerges out of that pupa.
And the adult is the first time it can fly?
Exactly, yeah. So as it's emerging from the pupa, it kind of pushes out, and its wings pop out, and then it moves around and flies around. And usually they will go and find some sugar to kind of boost their energy reserves. And then the female will then go on a search to look for blood so that she can start laying eggs. The type of water that is used for laying eggs really depends on the type of mosquito. So, for example, the type of mosquito that transmits malaria, the Anopheles mosquitoes, actually like to breed in clean water. And they can breed in, it's usually clean, sunlit, temporary water. So this is one of the challenges with trying to find where all of the mosquitoes breed in Africa, for example, because you can have many, many mosquitoes breeding in a puddle or a hoof print. Or a ditch on the side of the road, and imagine trying to find all of those puddles and treat those is a never ending task.
And they just keep being made new exactly, every day. Yeah.
And then you have the Aedes mosquitoes, which are the ones which carry diseases like Zika, dengue, chikungunya, yellow fever. And those mosquitoes breed in temporary water. Temporary standing water. So that tends to be things like, it can be coconut husks, it can be man-made containers like buckets or tires, or it can be bromeliad plants have been a big problem in the south in Florida, and were actually attributed to the mosquitoes that were breeding during the Zika outbreak a couple of years ago. And because the leaves of the plant collect water, and then the mosquitoes lay their eggs in those in the water that's collected in those leaves. Same thing as banana trees. They're also perfect for collecting water and supporting development of Aedes mosquitoes. The Culex mosquitoes, those transmit West Nile, and they like to breed in dirty water, very often water that's rich in organic matter. So if you have blocked drains or gutters that are blocked with leaves, you'll very often find Culex mosquitoes breeding in there.
Interesting. So even though some want really, really clean water, some want water that has a bit of a biofilm or something, you know, like a dirty sludge, the central theme is that it's standing water. Like, water that's moving is generally not a good breeding ground for mosquitoes.
Generally not, although there are some mosquitoes that do breed in moving water.
Oh, I hate them. They're making life very difficult. Interesting. But, so even that, yeah, of course, there's always an exception to the rule in science, isn't there? And so this is obviously, you know, it's about going out. It's about making sure that at least within your surroundings, you make sure that the bird bath is not stagnant, or that maybe you don't have a bird bath, or that you empty all the buckets, you turn them upside down, you know, any place where water could collect. You make sure it doesn't, because you don't want these clouds of mosquitoes breeding within close proximity to you. But of course, like you said, that is sort of, it's one thing to be empowered to do it within your own house or within your own, you know, immediate surroundings. It's another thing to talk about doing it through an entire city or village or town. It's sort of a proposition that's a little bit endless. So we got to get rid of the water. Like you said, we've got to make sure that we're using mosquito repellents, although they have their failures because of resistance. What else did we mention so far?
So that there are insecticide sprays that are used. And in the US, of course, you have a lot of space spraying that's done. And you would have seen a lot of that during the Zika outbreak in 2016, 2017, where you have trucks and these big mounted sprays. The problem with that is that very often, well, for a start, they tend to also kill whatever beneficial insects might be flying around at the time. So if you have butterflies or bees, they will also kill those. But they also will only work basically while the mosquitoes are flying around. So you have to be spraying at the right time. If you're, for example, if you have a lot of mosquitoes that tend to be out and active in the afternoon and you spray in the morning, then you're only probably going to get a very small proportion of those mosquitoes. And some people have, and some hotels and other premises have these kind of dispenser systems where they sprays or diffusers that release a small amount of insecticide on a regular basis. But those kill mosquitoes when the mosquitoes are, again, are out and active and happen to fly into the spray. So it is a challenge, particularly outdoors, to try to find things that will work on a continuous basis and target the entire population, because obviously the idea is to really have an impact on the entire population.
Yeah, so I assume those everybody in Texas used to have on their patios those horrible bug zapper things. I assume that those don't really work.
Oh my God! So, I have my own very personal opinions about these, which I'm going to share with you.
Yes, please. Oh, good. Yeah, because I just remember that was the stuff of a night. You know, an outdoor barbecue was hearing that horrific noise when something would like fly into the bug zapper and being like, oh, that's pleasant.
Yeah, but so those bug zappers actually, they work fairly well for house flies and other large flying insects like moths, but they don't attract mosquitoes.
Okay.
If a mosquito is killed by one of these devices, it likely flew into it accidentally. I once did a job for a consumer magazine that wanted to test a whole range of different mosquito control devices, mosquito repellents. So I had a huge range of different products, and I had some of these electrocuting bug zappers, and I had a small room where I was testing these things, and I put them in the middle of the room, released 100 mosquitoes, and closed the room and left it for 24 hours, came back 24 hours later and collected all 100 mosquitoes. And I did that several times with several products.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Scientists are saints. Let me tell you, that sounds like such a tough job. And what did you do with the mosquitoes? I mean, what about the ones that didn't die?
Oh, they were just mosquitoes that had been reared in the lab. So I probably killed them straight afterwards. But
okay. And they were clean mosquitoes. You knew that they weren't carrying any disease.
When they're reared in the lab, they're clean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but there's other things that people believe work, which really don't work at all. And you may have heard of some of them. So one of them is eating garlic. People sometimes, you may have heard this or not, I don't know, but eating garlic doesn't work. It won't repel mosquitoes. It might repel your friends or neighbors if you've eaten enough of it or squeeze it on your skin, but it definitely won't help with mosquitoes.
But then you'll just have garlic flavored mosquitoes later. We also, all over like restaurants in the South, there are plastic bags full of water hanging in trees. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't. This is sounds
I think
dangerous.
That's another. It's another weird folk. No, they're just little Ziplocs, like little Ziploc bags that they fill with water, and they tie them to the trees, and that's some sort of weird folk mosquito repellent. Also,
I haven't heard of that. I'm gonna have to investigate.
Anything to add? Yeah, to the pseudoscience bucket. So yeah, that's another one. What else you got? What else do people think works?
Vitamin B. I have a medical doctor friend of mine who'd was going to Costa Rica, and she asked one of the other doctors at her hospital where she works, and that doctor told her, oh yeah, you need to take vitamin B, but that doesn't alter your attraction to mosquitoes. It doesn't work either. One of the other things that really annoy me are these handheld clip-on buzzers. That I don't know if you've seen these. You have little things that clip on to put to push chairs or you just clip it onto your clothes. They're supposed to emit a sonic frequency that sounds similar to a male mosquito. And the idea is it's supposed to repel female mosquitoes because most mosquitoes only mate once during their lifetime. They don't work, and I don't like them because they give a false sense of security. So I think that it's so important because mosquitoes are such a public health. Yes, they're a nuisance, but they're also a public health menace that you really need to be investing in products that actually work.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen also these, like, they're like rubber bracelets.
Yes.
And I've never really understood. And they come in a multi-pack. I don't know if they're supposed to be like citronella scented or something, but like, how could a bracelet possibly protect your face or your ankles or, you know, anything that's not directly underneath the bracelet? I'm so confused.
You're absolutely right. So citronella is not a particularly effective repellent anyway. Most candles and things, the smell makes people think that they're working, but actually they don't work that well. These repellent wrist or ankle bands can provide some limited local protection when the band is worn, but they're generally inefficient and provide inadequate protection. And, you know, if unless you're going to have bands all the way up your legs and all the way up your arms and around your neck, it basically is not worth wearing them. It's much better to put skin repellent on, put it that way.
Absolutely. I remember when I went to, I have a travel doctor near Los Angeles in Pasadena, and they're so great. You know, they're just one of those travel clinics that only does testing and vaccinations. And I remember, you know, I had previously, when I had traveled to North Africa, gotten, you know, a whole bunch of vaccinations, and I was due for maybe my final hepatitis round or something like that. And we were just, you know, chatting, and she was saying, where are you headed next? And, oh, I'm going to go to the Peruvian, I'm going to go to China first, and then I'm going to go to the Peruvian Amazon and blah, blah, blah. And she was like, and what are you going to do while you're in the Amazon? And I was like, use insect repellent. And she was like, and what kind? And I was like, the real stuff. And she was like, yes, you're going to avoid the ones that say natural and drug free. She was like, you're going to get the ones with the real chemicals. And I was like, I like you. Because I do think a lot of times people are just, you know, it's a very Los Angeles way. And I don't want to limit it to Los Angeles. It's just what I see a lot in Los Angeles is there's a very kind of naturalistic fallacy, or whatever it's called, the appeal to nature fallacy, which is just that, like, if something is natural, it's not unhealthy. And if something has quote unquote chemicals in it, it's not good for you. So you see this avoidance of wanting to use quote unquote heavy chemicals. And I get it. DEET is gross. Like we talked about before, it's sticky and it like melts plastic, and you have to, you know, not get it in your eyes and stuff. But like, yes, something that's like, oh, it's lemon scented, and that's why it's going to repel the mosquitoes. Like,
yeah, I think it's there's a lot of misunderstanding, this belief that natural products are going to be inherently better. For a start, it's all about dose. You can drown by drinking too much water, for example. But water is safe for you to drink. But everything is or should be always related to the dose that you take in. And because something is natural doesn't make it safe. There are plenty of natural products that come from plants and other things that are completely toxic. So it's all depending on exactly what you're looking at and the use of it as well. And it's particularly when we're looking at things like mosquito nets, for example, the debate the use of putting insecticides on mosquito nets was shown in the 80s and 90s that it led to combining insecticide with a net led to massive reductions in mosquitoes that bit humans and a much better degree of disease control than if you were using an untreated net.
And so that way, I guess only because some mosquitoes can probably still get through or, you know, find little cracks in it, but they're going to be less likely to even fly anywhere near it if it's treated.
Well, actually, no. What happens is the insecticide on a net provides an extra layer of protection. So in addition to the physical barrier of the net, you also have this chemical barrier. And what happens is the mosquito, when it lands on the net, it searches to try and find a way in, try and find a hole. And as it's searching, it picks up the insecticide and then dies. And even if a net has a hole in it, and obviously as people use nets and nets get holes in, the more they're used, the person sleeping or people sleeping under that net are still protected. The other benefit of insecticide-treated nets is the what's called the community effect or the mass effect. And that's basically an effect that happens when you have widespread use of an insecticide-treated net on a mosquito population that leads to the majority of mosquitoes in that population becoming younger and therefore less of them are infected. And that means that even people who are not using a net in that area are still protected because of this so-called mass effect.
Neat. So it's like herd immunity with vaccines.
You kind of, yeah, exactly. And that's why
in the
90s, there was a massive debate about whether or not insecticide treated nets should be given out for free, just like vaccines are, or whether people should buy them. Eventually, they were given out for free. I mean, it's not somebody has to pay for them. A lot of the mosquito nets today are bought by the Global Fund and USAID money that comes from USAID.
Yeah, so NGOs and also government government-funded
exactly
programs.
But they've been attributed to saving 6.2 million lives from malaria, and the technology that we use today, which is called long-lasting insecticidal nets, are credited with reducing malaria cases in Africa by 68%. So they've had a huge impact over the last decade, 15 years or so. And it's because of the technology that, so the long-lasting nets are a technology that was developed to get around the problem that you have with just putting an insecticide on a net. So people who sleep under insecticide-treated nets, obviously they're going to wash the net just like they wash their bed linen. And the problem is that every time you wash your net, the insecticide comes out and then you lose your protection. And so in order to get around that problem, the so-called long-lasting net was invented. And it's basically a factory-treated net that retains its insecticidal efficacy for the three-year lifetime of the net. So you can wash it, and after you wash it, the insecticide comes back up to the surface of the fibers and continues to kill mosquitoes. And that enabled bed nets to be scaled up massively across the malaria endemic regions of the world, and then to have that impact that we've seen over the last few years.
That's incredible. And so you work with, obviously, like you said, you're a medical entomologist, you're a scientist, but you work with or for a company that specializes in these kinds of preventive measures. So what are you, a consultant? Like, what is the company that you work with? What do they focus on? And kind of what's your relationship with them?
So I work for the past 11 years, I've worked for a company called Vestergaard, which is the world's largest supplier of long-lasting insecticidal nets. I run our research and development and also market access division, which means that I'm looking at what are the new types of products that we need to develop. So one of our big focuses now is looking at the new types of insecticides that we can put on nets, because over the last decade or so, mosquitoes have been targeted with a monotherapy. It's the same type of insecticide that's been used, and mosquitoes are now becoming resistant to those types of insecticides, meaning that the mosquitoes are no longer being killed. They're managing to blood feed through nets. And if we are not able to replace those nets with products that have new insecticides or more effective formulations, we may start to lose some of the gains that we've already made. So that's a big focus. And another part is looking at how we can get new products to market, because the agencies that purchase our product require a recommendation from the WHO, so sort of third-party endorsement to have confidence in the product. And it's a very complicated space to get a new product through, particularly when there's no clear pathway to market. So a lot of the work that I do is working with large organizations like the WHO to figure out how we can get new products through and tested properly and show that they are doing what they're supposed to do.
You know, I mean, I can sense the amount of like frustrations and the red tape and some of the things that you probably have to deal with on a regular basis now that you've gone into this area that is a little bit more bureaucratic. But at the same time, it must be so fulfilling. It must be so exciting to have been able to go from a research oriented career, you know, to come out of academia, to do the field work, to do the type of work that you've always done in the lab, and then to actually be able to translate that to practice and say, like, everything we've learned, everything that we're doing, we're physically making products now, we're physically bringing them out, and we're seeing the global effect of millions of lives saved from this. Like, that's just incredible.
Absolutely. I've always been an applied scientist. So I've always been somebody who is really looking to figure out how to put the science into something that helps. Either use it in an efficient way to help a problem or put it into a product that can help solve a problem. And as our company has produced nearly 800 million nets since 2002, so protecting an estimated 1.8 billion people, which is a pretty amazing figure. And to be part of that is truly humbling.
Oh, it's just so incredible. And so is some of the, obviously you're probably in R&D in a lot of different types of projects, some things that you probably can talk about, some things you might not be able to talk about yet. But is the idea now to do, is similar to what a lot of GM scientists, you know, botanists and researchers who are interested in crossing and affecting, like through transgenes, genetically modified organisms, they're realizing now that if you want to make an organism that is like insect resistant or drought resistant or some sort of like blight resistant, that maybe it's better to have there be redundancy, that we're not just talking about one gene that protects, but if we have three things, then as the insects or the pests or whatever start to develop resistance to it, which is a natural process, this happens, it's evolution. We see it with our antibiotics, that it's less likely that an insect can develop like three different types of resistance. So is the idea now that you said before they were treated with like a mono chemical drug, whatever, yeah. Is the idea now to have multiple lines within the same net?
Yeah, so the idea is to use at least two insecticides in a formulation in the net to try to prevent the resistance from developing, but also have a higher degree of performance by combining those two insecticides. One of the challenges we face, though, is that a lot of the mosquitoes, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, have what's called metabolic resistance, which is a type of resistance where the mosquitoes have enzymes that work better or break down the insecticide faster so that the insecticide doesn't have a toxic effect on the mosquito. And there are more and more worrying indications that because of a lot of these mechanisms that already exist, they may have an impact on some of the new molecules that are coming out, so that you have cross resistance. So even though some molecules might not have ever been used, they're already redundant because you have some of these enhanced systems in the mosquito that are already very effective at breaking down some of these other chemicals.
So you've got those barriers in some aspects even before you start.
Exactly.
But it does seem like you guys are producing so many interesting products that you're really, gosh, just affecting change at a massive scale. Obviously, scaling must be a big issue, a big concern for anybody who does this kind of work. And now you've of course started to branch out. We were chatting a little before we started recording that you even have a new product that might be coming to an American market, which seems like, what? Why?
Yeah, exactly. So we're in the process of launching a new product in the US that can be used for outdoor mosquito control. So this is thinking about some of the problems we have with the Aedes type of mosquitoes that we've been talking about. That bite during the afternoon, that ruin your backyard barbecue and make it uncomfortable when you're playing tennis or going to your swimming pool. Mosquitoes that very often tend to rest in vegetation and shaded areas. And so what we've done is we've taken the technology from long-lasting insecticidal nets that has this wash-resistant aspect that enables the insecticide to last for a long period of time. And we've adapted it to use in a screen that kills mosquito by contact. So this is a fabric that has a fairly wide mesh, so it enables a good amount of airflow through. And the formulation is UV protected so that the insecticidal activity lasts for at least 2 years. And what happens is when a mosquito lands on the screen,
oh wow,
it picks up the insecticide and dies. And the idea is it can be used in a similar way to a privacy barrier on fences, around decks, porches, and even as a screen in windows and doors. And as a lot of these mosquitoes that we are bothered by in the US tend to live in a very fairly short perimeter, you're able to have a fairly immediate effect on that mosquito population. So, for example, If you have a lot of vegetation, bushes and things, you would put it on your fence behind those bushes. If you have a deck, you would put it around the railings of your deck. And what we've found so far is that surprisingly, you don't even need to screen in yourself completely. Just putting it around the railings of a deck or a porch is enough to stop those mosquitoes from coming and biting you. Presumably because those mosquitoes are interrupted on their flight path to come and bite you around your feet and ankles, and they basically get stopped as they land on the screen.
Oh, yes. This is amazing. I'm really looking forward to this. I can see so many practical uses even here around where I'm living. And I can only imagine if I were still back home where my parents and, you know, my whole family is back in the South, just how incredibly useful that could be. Gosh, Helen, I've been talking to you for now well over an hour. There are a couple things we haven't even gotten to, so I'm trying to organize my thoughts because I've got to let you go. But before I do, there's just a couple more questions I want to ask you if you're willing. The first one being, I think the big question on everybody's mind always when we talk about mosquito-borne diseases is like, why can't we just kill all the mosquitoes? Like, honestly, you know, there's work being done with CRISPR to genetically modify these things so that they can't reproduce or so that they can't carry these diseases. And of course, some of that I think is incredibly exciting. And some of it may be a little bit of wishful thinking, but of course, that's how science works. But what happened if we just eradicated every mosquito? Like, would the world not be a better place, or is that going to mess up some pollination?
So it's a fairly hypothetical question, so just a little bit of, very quickly, a little bit of background. What eats mosquitoes? You have, for example, birds that eat both adults and the aquatic stages of mosquitoes. You have frogs, lizards, bats, Venus flytraps that all eat adult mosquitoes. And then when you're looking at larvae, you have things like turtles, large tadpoles, and fish like goldfish, guppies, bass, catfish, and a particular type of fish called Gambusia that eats the mosquito larvae. You have other insects like dragonflies that eat actually both larvae and adults. But most of these creatures, the mosquitoes are not their only food source. So, for example, bats, mosquitoes make up less than 1% of their diet. And mosquitoes are pollinators of plants, but most plants are pollinated by other insects as well. And mostly no ecosystem depends only on mosquitoes to the point where it would collapse if they were to disappear, except perhaps there's some orchid species that are pollinated by mosquitoes in the Arctic, but that's about it. If we were to get rid of one mosquito vector species, for example, a vector of malaria in Africa, it could be replaced by another. In Africa in particular, you have, and also Southeast Asia, you very often don't just have one species that is transmitting malaria, but you'll have 2, 3, 4, even 5. And so just getting rid of one doesn't necessarily solve your problem. But you could then have it replaced by another type of biting insect. So, for example, a midge or noceums, these tiny little biting flies that also transmit some diseases like blue tongue and some other viruses. So mosquitoes do tend to eat some of the detritus in water, and they can contribute to keeping water clean, but so do other organisms. And mosquito fish, this Gambusia that I mentioned, they can eat 1.5 times their own body weight in mosquitoes in one day, which is huge. But they also need other food sources as well. So, a good example is in Australia in the 1920s and 30s, there were a lot of mosquito fish that were brought in to try to control mosquitoes. And the mosquito fish actually outcompeted the native fish and frogs to the point where the mosquito numbers actually went up because there were less predators overall. So it's always a balance.
Oh, wow. Yeah. But what I'm really gathering from this conversation is that if we did wipe out all the mosquitoes, the world would probably be okay.
It probably would, although I'm sure there would be another insect that would pop up and bring us another disease to take its place.
And that's really the problem, is that, you know, the ecosystem is in many ways in constant flux, but also finding this sort of balance, at least within these closed systems. And the truth of the matter is that includes these disease vectors.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, Helen, before I let you go, I ask every one of my guests the same two questions at the very end of the podcast. And I think because of your unique perspective and your just fountain, like your well of knowledge. I'm super interested in your take on these two questions. So they're pretty big picture, but goodness, if anybody works in a big picture capacity, it's you. So when you're thinking about the future, I want you to tell me first, what is the thing that you struggle with a lot? What keeps you up the most at night? And maybe it has directly to do with the kind of work that you do. I mean, wouldn't be surprising, you're really attacking a very big global issue. But first, what does keep you up the most at night and really concern you that you have, like, not always a positive outlook about? But then on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, authentically, hopeful, optimistic, and excited about?
So I would say in my current role with my current job, the thing that I struggle the most with is the complicated structures, mechanisms for getting our new products to market that are so badly needed. When it takes you more than 10 years to get a new mosquito net to market, which is longer than it takes for a cancer drug, there is something seriously wrong.
Mm-hmm. And by then, the work that you've done may already start to be undone, because you may be, you know, you have some sort of new type of science that's really effective. And 10 years is a long time. Like, these insects could be developing strong resistance by then.
Exactly. And we need to be able to keep ahead of the mosquito. And of course, the mosquitoes are evolving all the time. So the key really is to try to get new products out there as quickly as possible. But I think it kind of connects very nicely to your second question. There's a huge amount of fantastic innovation out there, and a lot of very interesting new ideas, whether it's from some of the new genetically modified mosquitoes for controlling the Aedes to try to get rid of some of those populations, to our new product for using in outdoor mosquito control, to some of the new kinds of formulations that we're looking at that will enable us to produce new products at a very competitive price and enable us to scale up much faster. There's a lot of things out there and a lot of really interesting science that hopefully will be able to save a lot of lives in the very near future.
Absolutely. Gosh, what fulfilling work that you do. And I mean, I think just as a general thank you from the world, I want to at least tell you how appreciative and grateful I am for the incredible effect, the incredible change that you're affecting across the globe. Helen, how can people learn more about, you know, the company that you work with, the products that you guys have, and actually the research that you're actively doing?
So our company name is Vestergaard, V-E-S-T-E-R-G-A-A-R-D, vestergaard.com. And our new product is Permanet. And you can find more about our product and contact us at www.permanetscreen.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It really was absolutely enlightening. And I have to admit, it's not always, I think, the happiest of subjects, but I had a lot of fun on this chat.
I did too. Thank you very much.
Of course. And for everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.